At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, and this is On Point. Hezbollah's popularity in war-torn Lebanon has only grown since the fighting with Israel stopped. On the last day of the bombing campaign, Hezbollah sent 246 rockets over the border. By the next day, its relief effort was in full force. Flush with volunteers and Iranian money, Hezbollah took charge of the rebuilding effort, leaving aid organizations and the Lebanese government on the sidelines, bolstering Iran's hold on southern Lebanon, putting Israel on high alert. Is Hezbollah on the verge of a hearts and minds victory in Lebanon? What might it mean for Israel and the U.S.? This hour, On Point, Hezbollah's triumph after the fighting stopped. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Edward Walker, former U.S. ambassador to Israel and Egypt, and Karim Mekdisi, political scientist based in Lebanon. But joining us first from Beirut today for the latest on the United Nations efforts to form a security force and the rebuilding effort in Lebanon is Borzu Daragahi, foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Welcome and thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Borzu, let's start with the news of the moment. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is in Beirut today to focus on building a strong UN security force in southern Lebanon. How many troops are now committed?
Well, at this point, it's unclear exactly how many troops are committed. I think that France has committed a couple thousand. Italy's committed a couple thousand. They're saying that they're going to have a hard time coming up with that 15,000 figure that was originally bandied about. We're waiting for Kofi Annan right now in an ornate ballroom inside the Lebanese seat of government. He's about to give a press conference within minutes, really, and hopefully he'll shed some light on that question.
Well, what's the common wisdom on the ground? If the 15,000 troop level is achieved, will it be enough?
Well, I think it's not even a matter of the number of soldiers, but also what their exact mission is. That's not exactly clear yet. Will they have a mandate to, for example, block shipments of weapons coming in from Syria? Will they have a mandate to interdict Hezbollah fighters as they go from village to village? Will they have a mandate to seize weapons and even engage in combat with militiamen? So there's a lot of questions still out there.
Well, let me ask you a question about the issue regarding how the Lebanese-Syrian border will be patrolled, or if it will be patrolled by the UN force. How's the discussion shaping up over that, and how crucial a question is that?
I think it's a really crucial question as far as Israel is concerned. They're worried about Hezbollah rearming. But it must be said that in 17 years of Israeli overflights over that border, they've not managed to interdict many shipments of weapons, if any. So obviously they're getting those weapons in. They have been getting those weapons in somehow. It's been surreptitious and clever enough that no one's been able to stop it.
More immediately, Israel hints or insists it's not going to remove the land, sea, and air blockade of Lebanon until the Lebanese-Syrian border is under control because, as you point out, that's how it believes Hezbollah is being rearmed by Iran.
Yeah, but however they're getting it, it's not even clear yet. You know, I mean, the Hezbollah guys I talk to say that, look, you know, we get those weapons, you know, however we get them, we get them. It's not that hard to get weapons. There's weapons abounding in the international market. If you've got enough money, you can get them. We don't need to go to Iran to get them. We've got plenty of cash, and we can get them through whatever means we want, and we'll get them into the country however we can. So it's a really tough question, you know. I think that there's a perception among the country's Shiite plurality right now that Hezbollah is really a force that's defending them against Israeli aggression.
So let me ask you a question about the relief effort in southern Lebanon. Various reports suggest that Hezbollah has been the fastest and most effective organization delivering aid. True, and if so, why?
Well, I think to some extent they don't have the accountability mechanisms of other aid organizations and the government. They were handing out big, huge wads of cash immediately after the cessation of hostilities, $12,000 to every homeless family in cash. You can't trace that money up. You can't trace that money down. And so it's very easy for them to just hand out this money out of briefcases. But it should be said that Hezbollah is a master of public relations, and they were very smart at getting cameras into the offices where they were handing out this money, getting those images out, and whether or not they're the lead in terms of doing the relief efforts, it's perceived that they're the lead.
And Borzu Daragahi, foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Joining us now from Beirut is Rob Mosri, country director in Lebanon for American Near East Refugee Aid, which has worked with Americans to distribute $7 million in meals and medical supplies to southern Lebanon since the fighting began. Rob, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Are Western aid groups struggling to find ways to help? They're said to be struggling. Is that true?
Well, I think that we're struggling from a number of ends. One end is that we have to, of course, comply with the U.S. government regulations that prohibit us from working directly with Hezbollah, and of course we want to comply with those regulations, and we do. At the same time, we do need to reach people that are in need in southern Lebanon and other places in Lebanon. And also, Bob, the situation here has been changing, very rapidly on the ground. NGOs, the way we operate is we do assessments of what the needs are, then we go back to our offices and we write proposals, then we look to get those proposals funded, and then we get out in the field and we implement projects. Like you were saying, Hezbollah, within 2 days of the ceasefire, was handing out wads of cash to families that had lost their homes. We're not able to respond that quickly to any change in the environment here. It takes us a bit longer to program our activities and to be able to respond. So I think it is definitely a challenge for NGOs working in Lebanon to keep up.
Well, it begs the question. As of just a few days ago, USAID, the Agency for International Development, was still waiting on plans from agency on the ground as to how it might help. Is there any sign of U.S.-backed help on the ground right now?
Yeah, absolutely. There are a number of NGOs, including ANIRA, that are delivering assistance in the south and in other parts of Lebanon already. There's food supplies being delivered. There's we're delivering kits for children under 3 years of age. There's water tanks that are being delivered, tents in some cases. There's a lot of activity going on the ground now.
Let me ask you more about Hezbollah. Describe what role Hezbollah has taken on in the rebuilding. What projects specifically are they taking on that perhaps have surprised even you?
Well, I think everyone's been surprised by the scale of their response. The commitment to provide $12,000 per family whose home was destroyed, and I think the figure was something like 15,000 homes that were destroyed. You multiply $12,000 times 15,000 homes, and that is a major, major commitment that they made within days after the ceasefire that is certainly not something that we can compete with. And we were quite surprised by the scale of that. Hey. Also, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you please, go ahead.
No, I was just, I think Borzu was saying that Hezbollah is very good in their public relations. Frankly, they're also extraordinarily organized in their response effort. They organize teams of hundreds of volunteers, engineers and social workers and field workers and other persons that are out there doing assessments and working to respond to needs. And that also was happening within a day of the ceasefire, and even before, in a way. So they have a capacity to respond that is impressive, and they have an organizational structure that is also impressive, even beyond the PR aspect of it, in terms of what they're actually able to do. It's been, I think, a bit of a surprise for everyone here.
What role has the Lebanese government played versus Hezbollah? What role has the Lebanese government played in getting aid to damaged areas?
The Lebanese government, in a way similar to NGOs and other agencies, they also have bureaucratic structure that they have to work within. For the government to allocate funds for rehabilitating infrastructure or rebuilding homes, that requires budgeting, it requires government decisions, it requires for government agencies to do assessments. And I think that at the national level, the government is still working on those assessments and figuring out what it can do. The Lebanese government doesn't have its own discretionary budget with which it can respond to the crisis. The Lebanese government really relies on donations from other countries to be able to respond to the crisis. We have the Stockholm Conference coming up this week, in which the Lebanese government is hoping to secure significant commitments of funds for rehabilitation and reconstruction. But they have not been able to respond in the way that Hezbollah has.
What's the attitude there toward the U.S. at the moment?
Well, I think it's quite mixed, Bob. One thing is clear is that there are many areas where people are highly critical of the U.S. Hezbollah, for example, in southern Beirut in the Dahia neighborhood that was highly devastated, within a couple of days of the ceasefire, you would find large banners with statements like "Made in the USA." And there's other, publicly visible, statements like this all around. And I think that there's some frustration with Lebanese who historically have not supported Hezbollah, that there's not been more support from the American government or other Western countries. But at the same time, it's not a time to be exacerbating this the conflict and fighting over who's doing more to help people on the ground. And we have to be very careful how we manage the public image of American NGOs and U.S. government, of course. I need to be highly sensitive as to how it manages its image in Lebanon.
But I'm wondering how you personally have been impacted. How are you looked on as an American bringing help right now amid those signs that you were talking about?
Yeah. Well, Bob, almost every Lebanese person that you would meet here, be they Shiite, Sunni, Christian, Druze, almost all of them know somebody in America, or they have family in America. Many of them have even been to America before. And people are quick to recognize there's this distinction between the American people, American organizations, and the U.S. government, and even that U.S. government support for, Israel in certain ways, has to be distinguished from other things that the American government does, that American NGOs do, and that American people do. So whenever I meet people in the field, and I meet all kinds of people traveling about, I've always been very well received. And there's a lot of appreciation for the fact that we as an NGO are doing what we're able to do in the field to help people.
Rob Mosry, thank you. Rob Mosry is country director in Lebanon for the NGO American Near East Refugee Aid. He spoke with us from Lebanon. Joining us now from Clinton, New York, is Edward Walker, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs. He retired during President Bush's first term. He's former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, president of the Middle East Institute, a Washington-based think tank, and professor of global political theory at Hamilton College. Edward Walker, hello.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm fine, thank you. Also joining us from Beirut is Karim Makdisi, Professor of International Relations at American University of Beirut. Professor, good day.
Good day.
Edward Walker, let me start with you. Has Hezbollah, in your view, from what you've seen, from what you've heard, from what you read, been successful so far on the ground in Lebanon since the shooting stopped? And what might that mean for Hezbollah's influence in Lebanon and Iran's influence in Lebanon, given that Iran is bankrolling Hezbollah's rebuilding effort at this moment?
Well, I think that Hezbollah has been quite successful getting off the mark very quickly. And that's critical when you've got the kind of destruction that's taken place in southern Lebanon and southern Beirut. And they're going to get a lot of credit for that. But I think you have to also keep in mind that Hezbollah is a sectarian-based organization. It is a political organization, and its reach is somewhat limited by those factors. So I don't know that this is a fundamental change in the influence and power of Hezbollah, either in Lebanon or in the region. Certainly, it is very, very popular right now because it stood up to Israel for the second time, and most people in the region see it as having won the confrontation, even though people whose homes have been destroyed may not look at it that way.
Well, how serious a problem is that image-wise?
Well, you know, it's the kind of thing that's going to come to people as they think about the issue and how as they think about the nature of how this thing got started and what right a militia has to drive public policy in a country, which is what Hezbollah did. And I think the aftermath or the after effects might be a lot more negative for Hezbollah than certainly the situation right now.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that as people in Lebanon start looking carefully at their future, they're going to have to question this whole concept of having an independent armed organization that can take the whole country to war. I mean, that's fundamentally unacceptable for any society or government and people. I think we were hearing the beginnings of talk of disarming Hezbollah before this particular incident, and I think we're going to see it come back in spades later on once people get past this immediate crisis. I think Hezbollah may have made a tactical error here.
Kareem Makdisi, your view on this. Has Hezbollah won anything by trying to win the hearts and minds battle post-fighting?
Yes, I think they did. I think the fact that is that they've gained, first of all, because of the war, because of the results of the war, and because of the fact that they were able to resist 33 days of Israeli bombardment and emerge from it quite intact, meant that they gained quite a bit of solidarity throughout, not just Lebanon, but throughout the Arab world. So I think they've, in terms of the post-war reconstruction, as I think your earlier correspondents were pointing out, that they were the first on the ground before the Lebanese government was there, before the UN even was there, distributing cash for those people whose homes were destroyed, and basically pledging that they would reconstruct their homes and their villages as quickly as possible. So they've gained, as Ambassador Walker was saying, I think they've certainly gained short run. Over the longer term, I think it's a question that's now being debated, and it's a little bit more complicated to say.
How is Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, now viewed in Lebanon?
I would say, as I said, I think he has gained a tremendous amount of popularity and support throughout the country, as during the war itself, the first few days. If you recall, before the war, the country was quite divided politically. And even the first few days after the war started, when it seemed that perhaps the Israelis would keep a limited attack on Saleh based southern Lebanon, it was tough to split 50-50. But as the Israeli attacks gained in ferocity, became more violent, more sort of encompassing the entire country's infrastructure and civilian targets, he gained more and more popularity and support. He's seen as somebody throughout the country, as those who like him, who do not like him, he's seen as somebody who delivers in his word. In other words, at the very beginning of the conflict, he had said that when he captured these two Israeli soldiers, that they would not be returned except through indirect mediation and negotiation and the exchange of prisoners in Israel. And this is today what we find out today from Kofi Annan and others, that this is exactly what's happening today. He pledged at the beginning of the war that any houses that were destroyed, any areas that were targeted, Hezbollah would take the lead in terms of reconstruction. And as we indicated, within less than 24 hours, their people were already on the ground distributing cash and making sure that their commitments came to fruition. So whether people like him or not, he has somebody, he's somebody who people take him at his word.
Karim McDeesey, hang on. Ambassador Walker, let's come back to you. How big an opportunity is this for Hezbollah?
Well, I think it's a substantial opportunity for them, depending, of course, on how they pursue it. They have certainly solidified their position politically in Lebanon. They have indicated they have created a power center. They've had a power center in southern Lebanon, but I think it'll be reinforced now. They're a force to be reckoned with. The question marks that come up and had come up before is their links to Iran. It is not it's not greatly popular to have a foreign country running things or being perceived to run things in a part of Lebanon. Lebanon's been the victim of this from all sides over the many years, and it's worked to Lebanon's disadvantage. So the linkage with Iran, while it's providing the money and the weapons, can also boomerang ultimately by creating the image of a organization that has divided loyalty, or a loyalty to someone other than the Lebanese nation. But you know, as Karim has said, Nasrallah is extremely popular. He is a consummate politician. I was talking to Bashar al-Assad and at one point a couple of years ago, and Bashar said that if he ever had to run for a presidential election the way we do in the United States, the picture he'd want would be to have his arm around Nasrallah, be the one that would have the most impact in Syria. So I don't think we can underestimate his charisma and his political skills.
Quick question, given that. Is it going to be a recruitment? Is this going to be a recruitment plus for Hezbollah in terms of attracting new followers?
I'm not sure. I think that Hezbollah is going to be very cautious about, for example, taking any outsiders. I don't think that that's what their objective is. So I don't see this being an opening for Al-Qaeda or for other terrorist organizations. Undoubtedly, in these months ahead, Hezbollah is going to have a stronger political position in southern Lebanon, probably than it had before, and that will be at the expense of other parties and other supporters. But I think it will maintain its the limitation of being a political entity inside Lebanon and not outside. And I think they're trying to identify with the Lebanese nation and state. I think I saw that Nasrallah was saying that he didn't believe that the capture of the two Israelis would lead to this kind of a conflagration. Which would tend to indicate that he doesn't want to take responsibility for the destruction, that he wants that to be solely on Israel's head.
Let's bring On Point listeners to the conversation. Yetta is on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, Yetta.
Hi.
And go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add that to the conversation that, you know, we've waged this war on terror and demonized and you cannot expect people to just sit back and wait for us to come in and help out. I mean, people have real needs on the ground, and whoever's there first is going to meet those needs. They're going to be welcome. And the U.S. is playing a policy of propping up Israel, and they have done that for years, and there are good reasons for it, yes, but, you know, We've got to be careful of what we're doing.
Professor McDeesey, comment on that?
Yes, I think Nicola made some very good points. It's an interesting way to compare. If you see how much effort and money is being put into supporting Israel in terms of their attacks onto Lebanon in the civilian areas and the destruction, not just in this war, but throughout the last several years and a couple of decades, including going back as far as 1978 and 1982 when Israel first invaded Lebanon, you'll find that if the United States administration perhaps put in a bit more effort into genuinely finding a way into the hearts and minds of people here, that you would find a real response from people here. it's something which Hezbollah is groups like Hezbollah are taking advantage of, and saying, you know, as I think someone in your previous reports had mentioned, that if you go to the Dahi part of southern Beirut, you'll find signs amidst the rubble that says made in the United States of America. And this is the new Middle East, and they instead of the Middle East, they say the Middle East. So they've got nice signs up at least to reinforce this idea that America is simply a brute force which is in league with Israel, which has only one objective, and that is to destroy not Hezbollah, but Lebanon and the Lebanese people and the Arabs in general. So when that compared or contrasted to, you know, the effort of some very good NGOs and some very simple society groups, but in the end, really, we're talking about a few million dollars here and there, which really don't compensate the amount of damage and destruction that's made. I think it's a lesson that can be seriously learned.
Ambassador Walker, is this a lost opportunity for the U.S.?
Well, I think we have many lost opportunities. The attitude towards the United States, when you do the polls or look at the polls of the people in the region, are founded first and foremost on Iraq and the belief that the United States went to war in Iraq to support Israel and to gain oil. And so this plays right into the same kind of prevailing mood in the region. I think it is very clear that we are far more effective and efficient in giving military aid than we are in giving any other kind of aid. And throughout my career, it has been a frustration for me, and I think for many of my professional colleagues in the foreign assistance area, that so much time is spent with accounting procedures, with trying to satisfy the desires of many congressmen and so on, that it takes forever for U.S. assistance to ever come on the ground. And by the time it gets there, nobody really recognizes or identifies it with the United States.
On the other hand, Hezbollah's reconstruction unit is called Construction Jihad. What, if anything, should we take from the name alone about the seriousness of Hezbollah's intent in this regard?
Well, jihad has many different meanings, but the meaning of this the meaning that's implied here is that this is an all-out effort on the part of Hezbollah and its people to achieve reconstruction and so on. It's what we would call a fundamental major effort. Jihad does not have the negative meanings under these terms that we associate with it in terms of military or terrorism activity.
Professor MacDiese, is Israel more secure or less secure in the wake of all this, at least at this point?
I think less secure. I think that Israel has to at some point come around to the fact that that the military solutions can't work on everything. They've got to push themselves, I think, full scale into a comprehensive peace settlement, both with Lebanon and with the Palestinians and the Syrians, for that matter, in order to ensure their security. Because at the heart of this issue is not just security for Israel, but you need to make sure that the security for the Israelis, as well as for the Palestinians and for the people of southern Lebanon and for the Syrians, in the context of a just settlement.
Ambassador Walker, your take on this?
Well, I think that the Israelis have a lot of introspection to do at this point. Obviously, the campaign did not go the way they expected. I think they will learn some military lessons from this, lessons that I thought they already knew about the effectiveness of air operations and its ability to control the ground. I suspect there'll be some real political recriminations in Israel. But you got to remember that Israel was sitting quietly around on the border there when their people were taken hostage and when Katyusha started falling into Israel. So, you know, I agree that what we should all be concentrating on is a much larger solution to this problem, because it's the only way to stop this kind of breakout. But once a conflict breaks out, I wouldn't expect any government to sit around or to respond quietly to that kind of a threat. So Yes, we should be trying to expand the discussion to talk about the Syrian-Israeli peace. Yes, we should be probably engaged in that, as the United States should be assisting in that. But we can't just explain away the fact that Hezbollah started this particular round.
But if Israel sought to break Hezbollah with the offensive, as some suggest, has exactly the opposite happened? Has it succeeded in strengthening Hezbollah politically?
Well, I think there's no doubt about that. I think that if the objective was to break Hezbollah, and I'm not sure that that was the objective of the Israeli government, that may have been the objective of the American government. But I think for sure that Hezbollah is stronger today than it was before this conflict. In fact, Hezbollah's position in Lebanon was weakening, largely because it had been based on its reputation as standing up to Israel, and Israel was no longer perceived as a threat before this. So Hezbollah was losing ground, and this has reestablish Hezbollah in the minds of every Lebanese and every Arab as the little guy that was courageous enough to stand up to the big bully.
Ali is on with us from Boston. Ali, you're on Point.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I would like to say that I went to Lebanon this summer for vacation. I took my children and my wife, and I was visiting my parents' home, and my parents' home was in the southern suburbs of Beirut. And that day I was visiting him. My father asked me to stay with them this night. I said, no, I'm going, you know, to where I am staying. So the next day, that house, my parents' home was completely destroyed. My parents live in a 7-floor building, and the whole building completely destroyed. The reason for my call is, I was listening the other day to the defense minister of Israel saying or claiming that they only targeted where Hezbollah was shooting from or where they are located. Or I could testify under oath and the court of law that building where my parents live, there is no Hezbollah there. No one was fighting from it. It was intentionally targeted civilian building, 14 apartments building, was down on the ground, and I don't know, I mean, who...
Well, I think we get the picture. Let me ask you this question, though. The building was destroyed. Were your parents killed? Are they okay?
Oh, no. My parents are fine because my father was living in that house, but at that night he was visiting my sister at a different place. So they are fine physically.
Let me ask you this question. What was your attitude toward Israel before the conflict, and what's your attitude toward Israel now?
Well, before the conflict, I was, you know, under the impression, because since I live here, I listen to the news that, well, they target only, military points or military targets, as they claim. But when I witnessed it myself, I mean, the whole neighborhood there, no one was shooting from these buildings, and they were intentionally targeted just to inflict damage and destruction on a civilian neighborhood. I think if there are crimes, really, they talk about crimes, these are the crimes that are being covered or, you know, no, I don't know what to say, really. And then the defense minister of Israel comes on the radio and to say that we are only targeting military targets. I think someone has to should look into this.
Edward Walker, one of the unfortunate circumstances of war, or what's your opinion?
Well, I think you'd have to ask the Israelis what their motivation was. I mean, one could logically think of a reason why Israel would want to take out a lot of the infrastructure that they took out, such as airports and roads and stuff, with the military objective of terminating or impeding military resupply of Hezbollah. Why they would consciously go after civilian apartments, I don't know. When this has happened in the past, I have always believed, as your caller did, that it was a mistake, not a conscious program. I think one of the real problems is that we're... both our military and the Israeli military are designed to fight a conventional war. They're not designed to fight an enemy that engages in unconventional warfare, or asymmetrical warfare, which is what the case is here. And we have a lot of learning to do about how to do that, because there is no question that while the Hezbollah was not in this apartment building, Hezbollah was operating out of other civilian areas, and there was collateral damage because of that. We aren't geared to that kind of subtlety in our military approach, and I'm not sure we can be.
Irene is on the line now from Boston. Hi, Irene.
Hello, how are you? I want to thank you for this show. I'd like to make the following suggestions. I think it's really important to look at the origins of this crisis, and I would take issue with what Ambassador Walker has said about Israel being very, very quiet prior to this. First of all, there's a long history of Israeli action in Lebanon South that goes back to the late 60s, certainly 78 and 82. Would come to mind as very, very significant periods where you had an Israeli invasion. Of course, you remember 82 when the Israelis got within a few days to Beirut. So there's a long history. We talk about history and memory in many contexts, and we need to do the same thing here. The origins of Hezbollah go back prior to the events of 82, but certainly the events of 82 had a very significant effect on their coherence, on their organization, on their reason for being. And the reason for being is not something to be neglected. In other words, there's a context, and the context, as some of your speakers have pointed out, is a continuing Israeli-Palestinian struggle that inevitably absorbed Lebanon and took place often on Lebanese soil. So I think that's an element that we need to understand. I would just point out something recent that many people have overlooked, but I think is important. Between December 2005 and May 31, 2006, at the United Nations, the permanent mission of Lebanon filed with the Secretary General and the General Assembly some 529 violations of Lebanese sovereignty committed by Israel in that six-month period. So the idea that everything was very quiet prior to that, I think, is not accurate. The other thing I would point out is that there was also a history of prisoner exchange. The last one was 2004. And prisoner exchange, I mean, between Hezbollah and the Israeli government. It was Sharon at the time. So it would be useful to take a look at that and see what the purpose of those exchanges were, what they achieved, and what Hezbollah thought they would achieve this time around.
Edward Walker, let me ask you this question. What's the possibility that this was intended by Hezbollah? Its popularity, as you pointed out, was waning somewhat. What's the likelihood that Hezbollah knew it couldn't win a military fight with a technologically superior foe, but that it still provoked the fight, intending to win the peace by being ready to deliver the aid necessary for the survivors after the shooting stopped? It would seem to be ready for the rebuilding. What's the possibility that this was all along for a Hezbollah Hearts and Minds campaign?
Well, I think it probably was, but I do think that they possibly did underestimate the reaction, because, as your previous speaker mentioned, there had been successful negotiations when hostages had been taken before by Hezbollah, and so they had a track record. I think the difference here is that you had a compounding situation with the seizure of a soldier in Gaza, which had already embroiled the Israeli government. You had a relatively new government with not very much background or experience in military activity. So it reacted quite violently to this, not wanting to compound this question of all you have to do is take some Israelis prisoner and Israel will give in. That's a very dangerous precedent that Israel already had established, and probably one they regret that they established before. As for the quiet, I think we're talking about this battle would not have taken place had it not been for the Hezbollah action on the border. And many of those violations have been air violations, as Israel has overflown, most of them has overflown Lebanon in order to collect intelligence and to remind the Lebanese that they've got a powerful neighbor.
And will Hezbollah be disarmed, do you think, or what's the likelihood that that's going to happen?
No. Hezbollah will not be disarmed. The Lebanese government isn't going to undertake that role. It's too big a mountain for them to climb. The international community is not going to take on that role because we don't want to get into the middle of a hot firefight with lots of casualties. Hezbollah will keep its arms, as will the Palestinians in the camps. The Lebanese have been successful in disarming a number of the factions that were involved in the civil war, but these are two big, big problems for them still.
Edward Walker, former U.S. ambassador to Israel, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Edward Walker is president of the Middle East Institute, a Washington-based think tank. Also, thank you to Karim Makdisi, professor of international relations at the American University in Beirut. A month of bombings reduced the cities of southern Lebanon to rubble, but the rebuilding process, as we've said, is already underway. And as we've been discussing this hour, Hezbollah is at the helm of the reconstruction effort. Bernard Corey is a renowned architect based in Beirut, and he's been watching the Hezbollah-led effort, and he joins us now from Beirut. Good morning, Mr. Corey.
Good morning.
What's your impression, Ben, of the damage to Beirut and southern Lebanon from the bombing?
It is it's pretty impressive, but what is more impressive is the proximity of the destroyed areas to other areas that other Beirutis live in, which have not been touched. And it's the same old story again and again. You have parallel projects happening in this country and different worlds living side by side. The southern suburbs have been destroyed, yes, very heavily, but I am about 7 minutes away from the core of it, and my office was still operational throughout this war. Haven't really been directly affected. This is what Beirut is about, and this is what Lebanon is about, and I think until we address this issue very seriously, there will not be a nation. We'll still be talking about a regional conflict, and we'll still be victims of that regional conflict. I overheard your previous conversations. You were talking about Israel, Hezbollah, but not necessarily about a national project.
Ali Bazzi, the mayor of Bint Zubayl, told the New York Times that he wants to turn his city into a model city. Do you see that happening?
It's very optimistic. I wanted to believe in such a project. I've been here for over 13 years. In my early years, I thought I would take part of a reconstruction effort that would be ideal in maybe Western terms, led by institutions. And that didn't really happen. We have built small fractions of the territory, polished city, the city center, and some very nice projects around that.
Why have you not been able to take part in the rebuilding effort?
Because the rebuilding efforts were very focused on small areas. Again, tiny projects that have not really addressed the whole nation. There has not been a true reconstruction effort in the last 15 years that addresses the whole territory. I have finally started my career, started building when I understood this problem and I started working for the private sector. I've never worked for institutions, never built private public projects.
Just a few seconds, Bernard Corey. Have you given up? Just a few seconds. Have you given up a hope of rejoining the rebuilding effort?
I have been rebuilding, but it's on a completely different agenda. You cannot talk of the reconstruction in Lebanon as you would talk about it, let's say, in a post-war situation in the West.
Bernard Corey, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Bernard Corey, renowned architect in the Middle East and internationally, on the line with us from Beirut. This is On Point.